Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls. Next week, when voters here in Champaign County go to the polls to make their choices in the presidential primary, they will also find a number of area candidates there on the ballot, including two Democrats who are competing for their party's nomination for state's attorney. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with the current Champaign County State's Attorney, Julia Reitz. She was first elected in 2004, and in next week's primary is facing a challenge from Urbana Attorney Alfred Ivey. He was here on the program yesterday. If you did not hear that show, it's on our web archive, so you can go back and listen. Also, I do want to mention, and I'm trying to mention a couple of times, that the two candidates will be meeting for a debate at the U of I College of Law. This is tonight at 6 o'clock in the Max Rowe Auditorium, 504 East Pennsylvania in Champaign, and a number of local organizations, including the ACLU, the Criminal Law Society, the Federalist Society, and the Program in Criminal Law and Policy are all jointly hosting this thing. And it's, again, happening at the law school on the U of I campus tonight at 6. It is open to the public. Anyone who is interested should feel welcome to attend. Here this morning on the program, of course, we invited your questions as well. If you'd like to talk with our guest, Julia Reitz, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. Again, we just ask people to try to keep their comments brief if they can, so we can get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Thanks very much.
Good morning.
For being here. There are a number of things that we want to talk about, and I know that you would actually like to have the opportunity to address some of the things that were said yesterday morning on the program. Before that, if I could just do, yesterday one of the first things I asked your opponent was what his interest was in running for the state's attorney. Now, you were first elected in 2004. Maybe I would ask the question in a retrospective sense. Well, what was it that in 2004 made you want to run for this office?
Well, I graduated from the U of I College of Law in 1993, and I had interned in the state's attorney's office at that during my third year of law school, and had an opportunity to see what it was like to be a prosecutor. And I really, it really struck me as what I wanted to do. When I came to law school, I had no idea what direction I was going to be going in. I always thought I'd go to some big firm in Chicago, do whatever they do up there. But having that internship opportunity really exposed me to what it was like to be a prosecutor. And so I got a job out of law school in the state's attorney's office here and worked there for 7 years, doing pretty much everything from traffic court to homicide cases and focusing primarily in the prosecution of child abuse and neglect cases towards the end of my time. Being a prosecutor to me was the ultimate type of law to practice. I mean, there's so many different types of law out there, and every lawyer has a different interest. But the prosecutor works for the people. We don't work for an individual client. We don't have to have somebody come in and give us a check and say, I want you to represent my interests, and this is what I want you to do. We represent the people, and our job is to do justice. There's a specific Illinois Supreme Court rule, special responsibilities of the prosecutor. We're the only type of lawyer that has our own special rule. There's no special responsibilities of tax lawyers or that sort of thing. And it says simply that the first responsibility of a prosecutor is to do justice, not merely to convict. And so really you answer to the law, to the people as a whole, and to your sense of right and wrong, your ethics. And so to me, that was the ultimate type of law to practice. So I was a prosecutor for 7 years, and then I went into private practice, frankly, because I was working at that time for the previous state's attorney, and we didn't agree on a lot of things that were going on in the office. So I went into private practice, and I got a lot out of my time there, seeing things from the other side. I actually represented a number of parents in those types of abuse and neglect cases that I had previously prosecuted. I did criminal defense work. I represented juvenile delinquents. And so I saw things from that side as well. all that time, I was watching what was going on in the state's attorney's office and was just not pleased at the direction the office was going in. There was a lot of decisions, I think, that were made really based on the political ambitions of the state's attorney as opposed to on that interests of justice concept. And so when the opportunity arose about 2 years before the election, I decided to go ahead and put my name in the ring. Hmm. And I worked for about 2 years going out into the county as a whole, meeting people, finding out what the concerns and issues were, and ultimately then winning the election in November of 2004.
Well, it is a political position, at least in the sense that you have to run for the office. Do you feel, are there cases where political pressure is brought to bear on your office trying to influence you to do one thing or not do something?
Well, I think there could be, and that could be political in the sense of Democratic versus Republican politics, or political just in the sense of university politics or whatever all else you might want to see as politics. But that's really where the prosecutor has to step back and say, my job is to do justice, to look at the facts, look at the law, and make my decision based on that. And, certainly if we look in the media, we see examples where prosecutors have lost that path. If we look at the Duke University case with the district attorney there, Mike Nifong, he disgraced us all, frankly. He made his decisions in that case based on politics, his own personal interests in getting reelected, the town versus gown politics in North Carolina at Duke University and in Durham at that time. And ultimately, it led to his downfall. And that has been a lesson really for prosecutors across the country. We talk about it at seminars. We read about it in magazines and articles. And we really have to take a lesson from that process that, that's not the way to go. And I think here locally, that was a lesson that we took from the 2004 election. I think the voters spoke very clearly that they weren't interested in the state's attorney's office as being, well, it is a political office, as being a politicized office. Mm-hmm. And I've tried, my focus has been on preventing that from being an issue in my office.
Now, we have a couple of callers, and I want to get to these folks, but again, I want to give you the opportunity to say anything you want, mm-hmm. comment, make response to anything that was said yesterday morning. And indeed, we may hear from some more callers who may want to press these issues, and that's fine. But I do want to give you a chance to respond.
And I appreciate that. I did have the chance to listen to the show last night on my computer, and that's a wonderful opportunity that you give your listeners and the public. And frankly, I was disappointed because there were at least two occasions where very serious misstatements were made about my office and my policies by supporters of my opponent. And these were things that he should have known were not true, and he did not take that opportunity to correct those individuals. This is where I get back to this idea of ethics and the prosecutor as the one who has to make the decision about what is right and what is wrong. And so specifically, the last caller called and suggested or said that my office does not give police reports and that information that is required to the defendants in their criminal cases. That is simply not true. The rules require that we provide all of the evidence that we have to the defendant through his attorney. And we follow those rules. There's no question about that. What the issue really there is whether or not we put those reports in public court files. That used to be the practice in Champaign County, but the Illinois Supreme Court rules clearly say that police reports and other evidence are not public information while a case is pending. That protects the defendant. It protects the integrity of the case. It protects the jury pool from having access to too much information. And so we stopped doing that about a year and a half ago. And that's simply that we're following the rules. Every other prosecutor's office in Illinois and across the country agrees with me on that. In fact, they were those district attorneys or state's attorneys that I talked to about that were surprised we actually did that in the first place. But I wanted to make sure that the record was clear that we do, of course, provide that evidence, those reports, to the defendant through his or her attorney, because that's required by the law. We're the state. We have that burden of proof, and we have to give what we have over to the other side. And, of course, we follow that rule.
And in that particular case, once the trial is concluded, then is all of that, then does it all become public information?
Then it would be considered public information. And under the Freedom of Information Act also, while a criminal case is pending, the police reports are not considered public documents, but afterwards they are considered public documents and can be obtained through FOIA requests, either at the police department or through our office. And so we're following the law as the legislature created it. The other very serious misstatement was made where there was a conversation about a Urbana police officer who was alleged to have sexually assaulted a woman while he was on duty. And the caller made it sound as if it was my decision not to file charges against that individual. And that's simply not true. And this is well known, and it's been discussed repeatedly on various radio stations and in various forums, that particular officer was a close friend of my husband's. And when that situation arose, I immediately requested that a special prosecutor be appointed, and I had absolutely nothing to do with that case. And so to say on the radio or in any forum that that was somehow my responsibility or my doing is simply wrong. And my opponent, I believe, knows that or should know that and should have corrected that at that time yesterday.
Right. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Julie Reitz. She is the Champaign County State's Attorney. She was first elected in 2004 and is facing a challenge in next week's primary from Urbana Attorney Alfred Ivey. He was here on the program yesterday. And as Ms. Reitz said, that is on our website. If you didn't hear yesterday's show, you can go back and listen to it again. And here we have the opportunity for folks to call in and ask questions. We have a number, and we'll start right in with the first in Champaign. Hello.
My question is, why is information contained in police reports released to the local media before a defendant has had a trial? And doesn't that practice contaminate the potential jury pools?
No. The rules allow the prosecutor to provide certain information as to the facts of the case, as to the date and time of the arrest, the charges that are filed, the specific information that led to the decision to file charges, because the public does have an interest in knowing why we're doing what we're doing. Also, we are required in court, in open court, to give what's called probable cause, and that is basically a summary of what the evidence is in the case to the judge. And in open court, anybody can be sitting there and listening to what it is that we stand up and say. So the information that we release to the media is simply that information. It is what we stand up and say in open court. And the rules do not allow me to go beyond that. And that's what happened in the Duke University lacrosse team case. Mr. Nifong, in that case, spent hours and hours and hours in front of the media elaborating on the evidence and adding things that weren't even true. And that ultimately is what led to him being disbarred and being charged with perjury. And so we're very careful to follow those rules and make sure that only the information that we release in open court is released to the media.
So when you released on the radio about Randy Hostetler on January 13th, and I'm quoting you now, you said the defendant and the victim were in the defendant's grandmother's home in Fisher, and based on the defendant's statements, they were planning on committing a crime, and a gun was produced. They had an argument. There was a struggle, although not a large one, and the defendant had the gun and shot the victim in the face and in the mouth area. My question to you is, how is it people listening to that don't think that Randy Hostetler shot someone? Aren't you trying the case already in the media?
That is the information that we released in open court in the hearing on probable cause. And so that is information that is perfectly allowable by the rules. There's nothing inflammatory. There's nothing out of line. That's perfectly appropriate information to release to the media to explain why it is that we were charging that individual with first-degree murder.
Okay.
All right. We'll go on next to Urbana. This is another caller here, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm listening intently, and I've heard Ms. Reed refer to a couple of things that I'd like to address and then pose a question to her. The office is supposed to do justice, and I heard her speak of ethics very strongly about her approach and making sure that she's ethical in what she does.
And you would agree, Aaron, that you were the one yesterday who accused me of not filing charges in the Kurt York case, right?
I'm glad that you responded to that, and I certainly have no problem letting everybody know that I'm Aaron Ammons. I am who's calling here, and I.
And you would agree that you and I have had numerous conversations about that issue in the past.
Yes, I would.
And that you knew yesterday when you called in. That was not a decision that I made, that I had nothing to do with the decision in that case. And yet yesterday you went ahead and accused me of letting Kurt York go free. You would agree that you did that yesterday, didn't you?
I would say this, that I'm not on trial here, and I'd appreciate the opportunity to ask my questions and make my statements, because I certainly will address the statements that I made yesterday. The statement that I made yesterday is in relationship to the fact that you have been campaigning pretty hard on the fact that you are very hard on sex offenders. And Mr. Yort was undoubtedly a sex offender, and you had the opportunity. The ball was completely in your court to prosecute him to the fullest extent of the law. And I understand from a legal perspective and based upon your relationship with your husband, by him being good friends with Officer Yort, that it was a conflict of interest for you to do so. So I understand that. I was simply making it clear to the public that it was in your court, though, and you could have passed it to someone else within your office to handle that case to make sure.
How would that not have been a conflict of interest if I gave the case to somebody who works for me? How would that not be a continuing conflict of interest? The law, the rules clearly state that if there's a conflict with any attorney in a law office, there's a conflict with all the attorneys in a law office.
Okay, so then I would wonder then, maybe this would be something that we can get into at a later point. Does that mean that every case that your husband brings before the state's attorney's office that we have to give it to a special prosecutor?
This case has nothing to do with my husband.
Well, I'm saying that you said that it was a conflict for you because the officer was related to your husband, right?
It was a conflict because Kurt Yort was a friend of mine and of my husband's. And I don't think that there's a question in anyone's mind that I had a conflict and I shouldn't have been involved in that case.
Okay, so I'm fine with that when you pass it to a special prosecutor, because I'm really dealing with the question of ethics and justice here. Because now, knowing that there was such a ton of evidence in this case against Officer Yort in that he allegedly committed this rape, and that there was all this evidence to support it, and it was passed to a special prosecutor. I move quickly to the issue of the Patrick Thompson case, in which everyone remembers the young man who was videotaping the police.
And again, Aaron, I had nothing to do with that case.
I think it's very rude for you to continue to cut me off. I'm simply trying to make a point.
And, caller, I wanted to give you the opportunity to fairly make your points and for Ms. Reeds to respond, but you know, I can't give you the next half an hour to do it. And I really appreciate it if you could kind of come to some point where you could give her an opportunity to actually respond.
I certainly would if you could just ask her to let me get my point out, and then we can respond to that. That's taking up more of my time than anything. So what I'm getting at is that there's a gentleman who is being charged with a home invasion and a criminal sexual assault or abuse without a single shred of evidence to support it, and you pass that case also to a special prosecutor. What I'm wondering from an ethical standpoint is, why haven't you made any public statements about your feelings and about the unethical or the unjust practice where a man who has tons of evidence that he committed a rape as an Urbana police officer against a young female never even gets arrested? but a young man who's being charged with a home invasion and a sexual assault, and there's not a single shred of evidence to support it, the special prosecutor wants to try him three times. Don't you think in the quest for justice that it's the duty of the state's attorney to step up and say, listen, I don't agree with this. If there's evidence to prosecute a man, I don't care what his position is, he should be prosecuted. And if there's no evidence against the individual, they should not be prosecuted. Why haven't you made any public statements to that extent?
Because that would completely contradict the point of saying that I have a conflict of interest and cannot be involved in either of those two cases. But now, Aaron, you and I have had this conversation repeatedly, personally, privately, in public, and I'm going to say officially now on this radio show that this is the last time that I am going to discuss this issue with you personally, privately, or publicly. If you call another radio show and want to bring it up, I'm going to say I'm not taking this call. This is the last time I'm having this conversation.
I think it's interesting for you to take such a position, because I don't see how it would be any conflict for you to, in hindsight, to come and say as the state's attorney.
Well, we lost the call. I'm sorry. I didn't do that. But I do feel that we just really have to move on. We're already at our midpoint here. We do have some other callers, and I would like to give them the opportunity to call in and talk as well. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Our guest for this part of Focus 580, Julie Reitz. She is the Champaign County State's Attorney. Obviously, there are some people here in this community who feel that the way that law enforcement has treated the African-American members of our community has been not good. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that the courts and your office gets caught up in that as well, because people, not just local African-Americans, but people see that that's somehow all part of one system, and that they feel that particularly black folks in Champaign County have not been treated well by the system. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think there is an issue across the country with the disparity in African-American presence in the criminal justice system. But there is that disparity in so many different arenas and issues in our society, teen pregnancy, single parenthood, low-income families. This is an issue that goes across many different societal areas. It's not just limited to the criminal justice system. So that being said, as the state's attorney, I have responsibility for one part of this big process. What I can say is that we don't look at race when we're making our decisions. We look at behavior and at history. And we make our decisions based on the facts and based on the law, not based on the color of somebody's skin. Hmm. At the same time, though, obviously, there are those disproportionalities, and we have to look at where does that come from. Well, we have a large number of African Americans in our criminal justice system. At the same time, we have a disproportionate number of African Americans who are victims in our community, who call the police and ask for the police to come and provide them with services. And those people I hear from regularly saying, we want law enforcement and the state's attorney's office and the court system to hold people responsible to keep our neighborhoods safe, to keep our children safe. And we have to answer to them as well. Mm-hmm. So, as I said, we don't make our decisions based on race. We make our decisions based on the facts and on the law. And I do what I can do to go out into the community and attempt to educate people on the law. I brought with me an article from the News Gazette from yesterday that is a wonderful article. The headline is Messages on Education, and it's an article about some local ministers who have gone to Central High School to speak with the young people at the school about staying in school and making good decisions and that sort of thing. And I applaud our local ministers for stepping up and going out into the schools and reaching out directly to the kids where they are. That's what really needs to be done. We can't expect them to come to us. We need to go to where they are and talk with them. At that level is where that change is going to really take place. Having our ministers be more involved, our parents, our social services, people like Aaron, who just called in, going out and making those, having those positive discussions and giving young people good advice about right and wrong, good and bad, that sort of thing.
Well, let me ask you this question. Because of your office, I mean, obviously the state's attorney has a close relationship with law enforcement.
Right.
And you have the opportunity to see, you know, you see what comes to you, and then you have to make decisions about who's going to be charged and what you're going to do. You see the evidence that it's presented. There are people who would argue that there are two different kinds of almost we have two different systems, one for minorities, one for white people, and that black people don't get that the standards applied to them is not the same. Do you see in what you see in Champaign-Urbana, do you think that that's true?
No. I think that there are issues in every police department. There's going to be individuals who make bad decisions. What I see, what we do is we review all the police reports that come to our office. So anytime either somebody gets arrested or they develop a suspect and they are requesting that we get a warrant or that we file charges, we review all of those reports. The police officers don't get to decide whether or not charges are filed in court. The victim doesn't get to decide. Ultimately, that decision is made by the state's attorney's office. It's my signature on the bottom of that piece of paper charging someone with the crime. And our burden of proof is much higher than the police officer's burden of proof. When they're out on the street and they decide to make an arrest, their legal burden of proof is probable cause. It's a very low burden. They don't have to look at the witness's background and credibility. They just look at the facts as they see them right there. Is there enough to say that a crime was committed and this person committed the crime? Obviously, because when you're out on the street, you need to make a decision. You need to deal with public safety issues without being able to sit back and analyze the entirety of the situation. When we make a decision as the prosecutor on whether or not to file charges, our burden of proof in court is beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a much higher burden, and we have to look at the whole picture, at the credibility of the witnesses, at the history of the defendant when we're making that decision. And so, because we don't do what the police officer did out on the street, that doesn't necessarily mean that the officer was wrong. That means that we're looking at things from a different perspective with a different burden of proof than they are. Now, that being said, there are plenty of times where we tell police officers and police departments in this community, you were wrong. That was the wrong decision to make. And I hear it from, frankly, from both sides. I hear from the certain members of the community, you're too hard on, there's too many African Americans, the police are too hard on African Americans, that sort of thing. I hear from police officers and from police departments, you're too easy, you don't file enough charges, you're, you know, giving too many breaks. So I think then that we must be doing the right thing because we are trying to balance the interests and the needs of both sides, of law enforcement, of victims, of the neighborhoods, and of defendants. The hardest part about this job is having to say no to people. That's where I get back to that, what I said at the beginning, that politics. You know, if you're constantly trying to please everybody, please the police, please the neighborhoods, please the activists, you're not going to make anybody happy. What you have to do is look at the facts, look at the evidence, look at the law, and make your decisions based on that. And ultimately, then, be able to look at the person in the mirror and say, did I do the right thing here? Did this meet the ends of justice? Sometimes that means saying no, and I've had to do that a number of times in my term, most notably in the Wilhelm case, where the young man was killed tragically. The bicyclist was killed by a woman who was using her cell phone at the time. And we had to look at that case, look at the facts and the law, and say we cannot file anything other than a petty traffic offense because the legislature has not given us a law that meets these facts. And that was very difficult and met with a lot of resistance and anger, frankly, from many different individuals across the country, frankly. But as time has gone on, I think people have grown to understand that there is this, this is what the law says, and if we want to address that, we have to go to the legislature and ask for some changes in the law. And that's what we've been doing. As part of that issue, I've been involved in the Distracted Driving Task Force in Springfield, and that has been a very educational and interesting experience to be able to represent state's attorneys to the legislature and tell them this is what we need as prosecutors in these instances.
We have some other callers here, and I want to get to some of these folks who have not yet had a chance to be on the air, and we are moving into about our last 15 minutes. So we'll go next to somebody on our line number one. This is somebody in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I would like to make a comment, and this is about the performance of the office of this lady. I don't know her, and I even don't know which part she belongs to. But the office people who work for her, they are very forthcoming. They are very supportive, and they are very, they educate you even. So I would like to compliment her for that.
Thank you very much. I will pass that on to my staff. I have wonderful people who I work with in the office. Many of them have worked for Champaign County for many, many, many years, and they truly see themselves as part of the criminal justice system and as part of this community.
It is not only, prosecution. I contacted one of your attorneys. We were dealing with a student who was a bit mental case, mm-hmm. and this person helped us. He went out of the way to help us, to get him in a mental hospital, to get him treatment and all those things.
Thank you.
This is really good.
I'm really glad to hear that. And that's another issue that we really need to focus on in the criminal justice system and in our community and, of course, across the country, is how we deal with people who have mental health issues. That has become a huge issue in the criminal justice system over the years as that access to mental health services has declined because of budget cuts and that sort of thing. In the criminal justice system now, we see more and more and more people who have mental health issues, who aren't getting the treatment and the help that they need, and then they end up either self-medicating with drugs or alcohol, committing crimes that when they don't necessarily know that, that they're committing those crimes. And we then in the court system have to find a way to provide them with the help that they need. And that's really not the right place for that help to come from. It really needs to come from, from another place. But unfortunately, because of financial circumstances, it is oftentimes it comes down to the criminal justice system to help people with mental health issues.
But I think you're doing a good job and continue doing that.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Perhaps I should introduce again for anyone who just tuned in. The guest, Julia Reitz, she is the Champaign County State's Attorney. She was first elected in 2004, and in next week's primary, she is facing a challenge from another Democrat, Urbana Attorney Alfred Ivey. He was here on the program yesterday. You can hear that on our web archive if you'd like to go back and listen. And also questions welcome here this morning. And I do want to mention one more time that both of these candidates, Julia Reitz and Alfred Ivey, will be taking part in a debate tonight at 6 o'clock at the U of I College of Law in the Max L. Rowe Auditorium. The public is invited, so you can stop by if you're interested in hearing more from the candidates. Let's go to another caller here, and I guess that will be line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead. Caller, line two. Go ahead.
Yes. The issue of ethics. In the campaign, Ms. Reitz, when you were campaigning in 2004, you made a campaign promise to the people working on the eavesdropping case with Patrick Thompson that you would drop the charges of eavesdropping against him. But is it true that you knew all along that you had a prior relationship and working on a case or something with him before?
Here and again, I'm really not answering these questions anymore. I'm not answering these questions anymore.
Ethics.
So you can just stop.
Okay, so
let's let somebody else ask a question.
Of ethics, You brought up the issue of ethics.
Okay.
And I'm asking
I'll say it again, as I've said it before, Aaron. I dropped the eavesdropping charges because it was the right thing to do. The charges had previously been dropped against Martell Miller. They needed to be dropped against Patrick. There's no reason why John Pylon didn't do the same for Patrick as he did for Martell Miller. So the first thing I did when I was elected, when I came into office, was I dropped those charges. Yes, technically, you're right. I had a conflict of interest because Patrick was a friend of mine and a client, and probably I shouldn't have done that. But it was the right thing to do, and there's nobody who's objecting to it. Again, this is the last time that I am going to discuss that issue, either privately, publicly, on any radio station. So there it is.
All right, let's go to Champagne. Someone else here, line number one. Hello.
Hi, can
yes.
you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, Julia. I just am very concerned about our high school youth. It just seems like since resource officers and things have been in the school that a lot more children have been criminalized for what is once teens acting badly, needing to grow up, and now is becoming criminalized. And by the time they're graduating from high school, they now have a record. And we're finding that when they, you know, when things happen, they're coming to you now with history. How do you think we can address this concern? And as state's attorney, what type of things do you think we could should see in the community to stop sending our younger teens to jail and prison?
Well, I disagree with you that more kids are becoming criminalized because of the resource officers being in the school. If you look at the numbers as far as cases that we're filing in the court system, that's not the case. We do have a wonderful process in Illinois law that's called the station adjustment process for juvenile delinquents. Station adjustments require basically the police departments to keep a case at a community level rather than sending a case over to my office. The police department is required to give young people that opportunity to come in. If they accept responsibility for their behavior, if their parents are involved and agree, then they can be put on what's called a station adjustment where they agree to go to school, to follow the rules, maybe to do some public service work, to pay restitution. And as long as they do everything that they're supposed to do and there's no other problems, then the report never even comes to our office. Also, our schools are using a lot of other methods to deal with issues. At Central High School, they've got a peer jury system. And I believe that our school resource officers really are working within the schools to try to deal with some of those issues. And school safety issues are very significant. We have parents who are very concerned about what they see going on in the schools. And what I see a lot of that causes me a great deal of concern is a lot of physical violence between girls in our middle and high schools. That's really becoming a huge problem. When I go and talk to students in the schools, I was at Edison Middle School a couple weeks ago. There had been a very large fight at the bus terminal between girls from the middle schools, and we spent a lot of time talking about that. Why do you fight physically with each other? And the answer in every group of girls and boys that I talked to was, we're fighting about boys. This is a serious issue because, you know, at the school level, maybe it might not seem like that big of a deal, but as it goes on, obviously it becomes a bigger and bigger issue. As I said before, too, I was thrilled to see the article in the paper yesterday about our local ministers going out to the schools during the lunch hours and talking to young people there in the school setting. That's something that really needs to be expanded and increased in all of our schools. Having people who are influential, who can have an effect, showing up at the school and talking to our young people sends a wonderful message and really can make a difference in what happens in our schools on a day-to-day basis. I know the principals welcome that, and so I would urge anyone who could be influential to get involved. Similarly, there have been articles recently about mentoring programs, really encouraging people, particularly African-American males, to step up and become mentors and get involved in these young people's lives. That's how change is going to take place.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Yes, that pretty much does. My concern, too, is a few of the students that I've talked to just with stories and contacting us, they're really afraid, and they often, like, plead guilty when they really have a legitimate case.
Well, nobody can force anyone to plead guilty, and the judges always ask people numerous questions to make sure that somebody isn't being forced or threatened or coerced. I mean, ultimately, it is the defendant's right to plead not guilty and to have a jury trial or have a trial in front of a judge, and people should exercise those rights. Everyone is represented by attorneys in court, and if they choose to...
I think that's the biggest concern, is that the public defenders are so overwhelmed that people aren't receiving proper representation. We have many cases of people that go to court and they have not had, or they talk to their public defender about their case, or their public defender is not informed, not prepared. They tell their public defender to ask for certain things, call certain witnesses, and they don't get that. I understand that, you know, they have the right to seek private attorney, but most of them can't afford that. And we've seen that public defenders' work caseloads are double the recommended amount.
Well, my attorneys have similarly large caseloads. I think we have a wonderful public defender's office here, full of people who are very dedicated to their clients. They work very hard for them. And I really can't address your concerns about the public defender's office because I'm not the public defender. But I do believe that they make sure that their clients know they have a right to go to trial. And they go to trial in many cases. If their clients don't want to plead guilty, then nobody's forcing them to plead guilty. They have a perfect right to stand up in court and say, I'm not guilty and I want a trial. And then it's our job to present the evidence that we have and prove our case. And we accept that responsibility very openly. We're not going to go forward with a case unless we believe that we have enough evidence to put in front of a jury and have the jury find the person find the person guilty by beyond a reasonable doubt. And so if there's anyone out there who's listening, you have an absolute right to plead not guilty and go to trial.
I want to try to get at least one more caller. We only have about 5 minutes. The next is someone in Urbana. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hi. What I'm going to be describing has occurred before you took office, so it may or may not still be the case. But I just want to throw out some observations that I made. In attending court appearances for quite a few young people, and that is that there seemed to be an ethic in the state's attorneys that said, basically, I don't care who you are or what you've done or, you know, how trivial or how great it is, I'm going to seek the greatest possible penalty I can get.
And you're talking about my predecessor's term.
Well, right. I said, I don't know if that was the case still or not, but I'm just describing what I saw then. I'm wondering if you have any comments on that, whether that's still the case. But, you know, it seemed back then that the state's attorneys basically just had contempt for anybody who came in front of them and wanted to get the greatest possible sentence. It was as if it were an ego thing, and I was really incensed in a lot of those situations because I knew the background and I knew that these kids needed a break. And
right.
I don't know what this. I hope it's a lot better now. But I would just like to. I'll get off the air and just let you address that.
Well, I can say that I have a very different philosophy, and I think you can see that in the numbers comparing 2003 to 2006 as far as the charging decisions we made. And a number of people left the office when I came in, and so we have had a very different change in the attorneys and our attitudes. And we really do try to come up with ways to help people, if they're willing to become productive members of the community. So we have a program called Adult Diversion, where rather than filing charges, somewhat similar to that station adjustment process I was talking about for juveniles, rather than filing charges for first-time offenders, we give them an opportunity to go to the diversion program if they accept responsibility for what they did. They have to go in front of a panel of community volunteers, and I always urge people, if you're interested in the criminal justice system and doing volunteer work, we're always looking for community members to be on our panels. And the panel decides what the individual has to do as far as public service work, restitution, counseling, that sort of thing. And as long as they do what they are told by the panel, then no charges are filed at all. So we have really increased our numbers of cases in adult diversion. Also, when we're making charging decisions, we have a number of options in the law as far as what we can and what we can charge given a fact situation. So one thing that used to happen all the time in Champaign County was they charged people who committed shoplifting offenses, really, with burglary. Because under the law in Illinois, if you enter a store with the intent to commit a theft, that is a Class 2 felony burglary. It can also be a misdemeanor theft, but it was usually charged as a burglary. So in 2003, the state's attorney's office charged 660 burglaries. In 2006, in my term, we charged 210 burglaries. We have charged more thefts, misdemeanor thefts, felony thefts. There are lower classes of offenses, but we aren't overcharging. So you can see that in the numbers there. We have increased the use of drug court, which is an opportunity to keep people out of prison, give them that chance to get really intensive treatment for their substance abuse issues, and we're at capacity at our drug court, and we'd love to expand that. But funding-wise, we're limited right now, and we can't expand because if we expand too far, then people won't get the adequate services that they need. And so my philosophy really is to give people that opportunity to rehabilitate themselves, to become productive members of society, because that benefits all of us. But at the same time, if there are people who are committing serious crimes, who have been given opportunities in the past and continue to violate the law, then we're going to hold them accountable for their behavior, because we have to do that to protect the public.
We're just about at the point here where we're going to have to finish, and I'm sorry, I think we have one more caller. Maybe we can take the one question I would like to ask at the end here and have you talk for a minute or two about, and I also asked your opponent the same thing. I think for some time now there has been some concern here in Champaign County about the makeup of juries and
yes.
them not representing the community as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
If that is something that you would say is a concern, what do you think it should be done?
I think that is a concern, and we have made changes in our jury process to try to make it easier for people to serve. So in the past, you had 2 weeks that you had to serve. We've cut that down to 1 week terms generally. That's a lot easier for people as far as work and childcare and that sort of thing is concerned. There have been discussions at the county board level about increasing the fee that jurors are paid. That I would have no problem with. And I try to go out when I'm out speaking and educate people and really encourage them to get involved in the process to when they get that summons to show up. We have a very high number of people who simply don't show up. I always tell people, too, that there are very few limitations on jury service. We pick our jurors from driver's license, Illinois ID holders, and voter registration. So you don't have to be a registered voter. If you have an ID or a driver's license, you still can serve on a jury. Convicted felons can serve on juries. That's something people often are mistaken about. And so they think that they're not going to get on simply because of a criminal history, and so they don't show up. I encourage people to participate because that's one of the wonderful rights and responsibilities of being a citizen in the United States. Similarly with voter registration, it's truly an honor to be able to go in and punch that ballot and decide whether or not I'm going to be the state's attorney, who the president is going to be, all of those things. And so I encourage students when I go to school, when you're 18, the first thing you should do is go and get registered to vote. By education, I think that's one way that we can help deal with that issue that we have. And it's not just us. I mean, if you look at across the country and in many other court systems, that is an issue that we struggle with.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the concern is that the potential pool is thin on mm-hmm. African Americans, do you think that either the bigger problem is that people are being called, people are actually being called, you know, they're mm-hmm. getting the notice that says come down, and either they can't or they're ignoring it, is it that, or is it that, in fact, enough people are not being called, they're not getting the notice in the first place?
Well, the computer is entirely random. So the question there could be, is there some other way other than driver's license, ID holders, and voter reg to come up with that pool? And that's a possible issue, you know, that could be addressed. But at this point, my concern is people actually coming, whether they're able to or whether they simply choose not to. And I would say, too, from a prosecutor's perspective, first of all, it's illegal, it's inappropriate to remove someone from a jury simply because of race. But it wouldn't be a good idea. We want to have people who represent the community, who have an understanding of how a certain issue might affect them, their community, their neighborhood, and to have a wide variety of people sitting on a jury is really much more beneficial to us as prosecutors.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop there. I want to say one more time that our guest this morning, Champaign County State's Attorney Julia Reitz, will be meeting with her challenger for the primary next week, Urbana Attorney Alfred Ivey, in a debate that's taking place at the University of Illinois College of Law tonight at 6 o'clock in the Max Rowe Auditorium. That's on East Pennsylvania, 504 East Pennsylvania Avenue in Champaign. Public is invited. It's open to anyone who would like to attend. Also, her challenger, Alfred Ivey, he's an attorney in Urbana. He was on this program yesterday, and you will be able to, if you missed that conversation with him first time around, you can go to our website, which is will.illinois.edu, and you can listen. Thanks very much for being here. We appreciate
it. Thank you for having me, and thank you to all the callers.